necessary experience for me to give an applied math talk. Many materials, like for example this aluminum or the steel and materials you're sitting on, metals and ceramics, are divided into lots of little crystals called grains. So the typical picture people draw in two dimensions looks something like this. So the whole space is filled with these grains, and then with these crystals, and then the crystals butt up against each other. So there's a theory in two-dimensional space. You can actually do this in the laboratory. You make a very thin film. I was looking at some of these in Pittsburgh just now. You make a very thin film, and then it behaves like a two-dimensional grain. Or you can do it in three dimensions, and it's sort of like filling space with blocks of various sorts. And the properties of material depend very much on this grain structure. You would like to understand this grain structure. Now, there's something called, which I'll call the standard model. There's no standard name for it. Of these grains. Or some people would call it the isotropic model. So it goes like this. So I'm going to describe the standard model. So the standard model says that when these surfaces tend to be smooth. I should say the size of these grains are about halfway between us and atoms. So they're something like, in a typical material, they're something like 10 to the minus fifth meters. So they're large enough that you treat them as if they were sort of continuous, but they're small enough that it's hard to see them without a microscope. Okay. So the standard model is that the angles that these make are 120 degrees, and in three dimensions the walls come together in three at a time in corners, and the dihedral angle is 120 degrees. Now, as time goes on, the grain boundaries are moving around. This whole picture is in flux as time goes on. The rate of motion increases dramatically with the temperature, but even at room temperature, these grain boundaries are sort of moving around. It's sort of frightening when you think about being in a skyscraper, which is held up by these steel beams, and inside those steel beams are all these grain boundaries, which are sort of wandering about. So how do they wander in the
atoms are not
point course across
green
boundaries. Sure. No, I mean if that works.
You shouldn't worry, that's what I'm saying.
But actually one of the things they said me at Carnegie Mellon is if you apply ammonia to bronze, all of a sudden those forces across the grain boundaries disappear and the thing falls out into its individual grains. And so you have this pile of grains, you can measure them. And anyhow.
So in skyscrapers don't carry ammonia. In bronze skyscrapers don't carry ammonia in the
So in the standard model, what... So you have some boundary that's going like that. The standard model is that this boundary moves by mean curvature flow. That is, at every point on the edge here, you have a curvature vector, which is sort of pointing towards the concave direction. And then a little bit later, the grain boundary will look like this. Or in free space, you have a surface which is moving. You have two principal curvatures, and it moves according to the sum of those curvatures. And then what happens is of a lot of interest to to topologists, what happens is there are two types of discontinuous things. So first of all, you have triangles like this, which disappear. So this becomes that in two dimensions, and you have edges which disappear and reappear with the opposite orientation. So these are sort of like catastrophes or discontinuities. And there's a corresponding, there are only two such pictures in two dimensions. In three dimensions, there are three such pictures which are well known to topologists, but I won't try to draw them. Okay. So that's the standard model. Is it a good model? Well, it's pretty good, and there's a lot of simulations of it, and also a lot of experiments, and the simulations do pretty well with respect to experiment. There are some definite things wrong with it. In the real world, why is this moving by mean curvature flow? It's moving because although there are connections across the grain boundary has an energy cost. The atoms like to line up in crystals, and so at the grain boundary, they're not lining up in crystals, and that has an energy cost. You want to decrease the energy, and the mean curvature flow decreases the area of the length in two dimensions, or the area in three dimensions of the boundary. Now, in reality, that energy cost has to do with the orientation of the two neighboring grains plus the angle of the grain wall. So it's a little bit more complicated, but and there are also special things that happen in the real world, like dirt collects on the grain boundary or something like that. But in any case, it's a pretty good model, and the you have. I was trying to show it in this. You have curvature like this. If there's curvature right next to the junction, this will go down that way, that'll go down this way, and the junction will move. So if you think about it or you simulate it, there's a maintaining the 120 degree angle moving by mean curvature flow. That dictates the motion of the junctions, which, by the way, is another. I mean, how realistic that is another thing that people discuss. But in any case, as I say, this is very close to what happens in reality because it's matched with computer simulations. Now, the big price... So it's worthwhile studying this, and already this model, there are all sorts of things that are unknown. So the big prize is you would like to say that no matter what configuration you start with, the statistical properties of the limiting configuration are going to be independent of where you started. In particular, the distribution of the sizes of the grains should be independent. So a huge number of simulations, it always seems to be independent. On the other hand, nobody has actually even a formula. It's not like a lot of these conjectures in statistical mechanics where everybody knows what's probably true and they just can't prove it. Here, nobody knows what's probably true. People have guesses as to what the formula for the distribution of the asymptotic sizes of the grains is. No, and it's not clear that it's independent of the initial conditions. And I say, I should say what I mean by stability is some statistical stability. Statistical stability after rescaling the length. The grains on the average are growing larger because grains are disappearing, and so the average grain size is going up. So the conjecture is that after it's reached this asymptotic, I have a distribution of geometries, some probability distribution, and then if I wait longer, I'll have a probability distribution of geometries that are in general larger. If I scale those back down, probabilistically it'll be the same distribution of boundaries. So that would be the conjecture. If you could prove that conjecture, you would have done something completely wonderful But anyhow, no one's close to it. Or close to detailed statements about the geometry. There's one statement about this model, and in two dimensions, this is due to von Neumann and Mullins. In 1952, and Mullins a few years later, and that is that this is for two-dimensional grains in two dimensions, following the standard model, which I'm assuming from now on, and that is that the time derivative of the area of an individual grain, so I'm focusing on a particular grain D, is some universal constant which depends on the temperature and the material times the number of triple points around G minus 6. A wonderful formula. It says if you, in a two-dimensional grain, if you want to figure out whether it's growing or shrinking, so I'll have some grain, it'll have a certain number of triple points around it, and I just count those, count the triple points, which is the same as sort of the number of edges, and subtract 6, and that tells me, you know, if it has 6 sides, its area is constant. If it has more than 6 sides, it's growing. If it has fewer than 6 sides, it's shrinking, and the rate is given by this. Now, I wanted to show positive. Yes. However, given the 120 degree restriction, if there's some inside, they can all be, I mean, you can, pursuing the line of thought you're on right now, you can give a proof of the von Neumann formula. It only took a paragraph or so. So I meant to bring a movie of this, but my computer broke down. It's really spectacular. I mean, I remember on the web, and you just watch them, and you see, I mean, you see whether it's growing or shrinking, and you count the sides, and it looks completely mysterious if you did that it could be so accurately true. Sorry? Two-dimensional grain growth. Yeah, I mean, there's a huge industry simulating these.
But this is not statistical. This is
exact.
Yeah.
My question, which nobody knows how to do, is statistical, but this is exact. Well, let me, in lieu of, wait. So, for example, if I have this situation, and I call these grains A, B, C, and D, and they all start out with a certain volume. So this is volume, and this is time. Well, A has 7 sides, so so it's growing. And B has 7 sides, so it's growing. And C has 3 sides, so it's shrinking. And D has 6 sides, so its volume is staying constant. But then in a certain moment, C shrinks to the point that I have one of these catastrophes like this, and then it's not there anymore. But now, at the catastrophe point, now A has 6 sides, so it's constant, and B has 6 sides, so it's constant, and C has, did I do that right? Sorry? D. And then D was constant, then begins to shrink. Thank you. So it looks something like this. And as you might expect, the volume of the whole thing doesn't even see that catastrophe that happened in the middle, because after all, it was far away from the boundary of the whole thing. So anyhow, that's what happens with the von Neumann situation. Now, already when von Neumann's thing appeared, people said it would be nice to do this in three dimensions. So what happens in three dimensions? Well, you can do a scaling argument. If you have in two dimensions, it's easy to see just from the standard model that if I made the whole thing bigger, that the rate of change of area would not change. That if I scaled the whole picture to be larger, the rate of change of area of an individual grain would not change in that scaling. Whereas in three dimensions, again, if you just do a dimensional analysis, the d of volume, dt, scales as length. So you couldn't possibly have a sort of a purely topological accounting thing. It's not a number, it should be a length. So somehow you want to associate to this grain a natural notion of length, as you often do in applications. You have some region in free space, and you have something that scales as length, and so you'd like to talk about a characteristic length of the thing you're looking at. And so we need a length scale for a grain. Okay. Now, there is a length scale called the mean width, which is known to a small group of mathematicians, but isn't very widely known, and I think, I think it's clear it should be more widely used in applications. And so the main point of this talk is to advertise this mean length, L1 of, say, G, if G is some region in free space. Well, L1 of G is defined to be twice the average over lines L through the origin. Doesn't matter where you pick your origin, of some quantity E sub L, where E sub L is equal to the integral over L of the Euler characteristic of L, the plane perpendicular to L at P intersected with G dP. Okay, so that's the definition. Some funny mixture of integration and Euler characteristic. That's all right. Sorry? P is a point in L. So let me just illustrate this. So suppose my blob of three space looks like this. It's some piece of clay kind of bent along this way, and suppose L is like this. The general picture is this is L, this is some point P. L perpendicular at P looks like that, and if the thing I'm taking the mean width of is some object in space, then that will cut that object in some picture, and then I get a picture in this perpendicular. This plane here is L perpendicular at P. I get some picture in that. In this case, it's a picture like this. And the Euler characteristic just means take the number of components or pieces of this minus the number of holes in that. So, for example, if I cut the thing and had a region that looked like that, then the Euler characteristic would be 1 because there are two pieces and one hole. And so 2 minus 1 is 1. Okay. And then this value will depend on where I am here. So if that's L, if I'm to the right of the perpendicular projection at that point, then obviously this function I'm integrating is 0 because there are no points in the intersection. If I'm in this region here, the function is 1 because I have one piece and 0 holes. If I'm in this region here, the function is 2 because I have 2 pieces and 0 holes. There are the 2 pieces, and then I go over one further and the function is 1 again, because I have 1 piece. So I get this function, and I integrate it, and so therefore I don't care what the values are at those points, and then I average that over all L's, and I multiply the result by 2, and that's this wonderful thing. Okay, so if this looks uninspiring to you, it looks uninspiring to everybody. Nobody can imagine, when they first see this, at least no one I've ever talked to can imagine that it's an interesting thing. So I want to talk about it a little bit. Well, first of all, let's do it for a sphere of diameter d. So suppose I have a sphere of diameter d. Well, then if I take any L whatsoever, I'll get 1 if I'm in the projection of the sphere, because I have one blob, so it's 1 here, whereas this is d, obviously, and so the average, since the value is 1 on every sphere, the average value, since the value is d on every sphere, the average value is d, and so the mean width is 2d. So L1 of S is equal to 2D. So for spheres, it gives the diameter up to a multiple. Suppose I had a sphere and I took an ice cream scoop and scooped out a solid sphere and took an ice cream scoop and scooped out a region inside. Well, then, so this is a sphere S and I scooped out a sphere S prime. Well, then, again, doing the same thing, I'll have 1 here and 1 here, but in this region in between, if I look in the plane, I'll have an annulus, the region between those two spheres, and its Euler characteristic is 0 because I have one region and one hole, so I have a zero there. And so the answer is that that L1 of S minus S prime is equal to 2 times D minus D prime, which is equal to L1 of S minus L1 of S prime. Okay, so that's already kind of nice. And I did that because it begins to illustrate that maybe there's some theory here. That's a nice formula. And we'll come back to that later. Let me do a little chart. Yes. Yes. I mean, they're interesting questions in analysis. What sets of regions you want to consider? But okay. So I was just talking about L1 of a region in space, as Jim just said. You can also, it doesn't have to be a region, it could be, so for example, if I take L1 of a piece of surface like this, then I get one half the perimeter. And if I take L1 of a one-dimensional thing, then I get the length. And if I take L1 of a bunch of points, I get zero. Now, it didn't have to be, this is part of a family, so let me introduce the whole family. You get the other things in the family by replacing this line by some space of other dimensions. The one refers to the dimension of the line. So if I took a plane, I mean, L2, I would take a plane, take the perpendicular, and write out exactly the same formula. So let me just add those to the chart. L2 of some blob, some region in space, is one half the surface area. And L2 of a surface is the area, and L2 of a line is zero, L2 of a bunch of points is zero, L3, there's nothing wrong with L3 of a region in space, is equal to the volume, and L3 is zero for a surface or a line or a point. And there's even an L0, this makes equally good sense for zero. L0 of anything is equal to its Euler characteristic, as you quickly see by looking at that. And the only one I want to emphasize is that L0 of a bunch of points is equal to the number of points. Okay, now it's time for my polemic. Here we have a chart, and everything on this chart is well known to any college freshman to be the most interesting thing in sight. If you're interested in some of the scales like the volume, I mean we ask people to compute volume, surface areas, perimeters, lengths, and so on. Maybe the only funny thing on the board is Euler characteristics, so maybe you need to know a little topology to decide that that's good, but certainly people would agree that counting points is good. So the only thing on the board that's mysterious is L1 of a blob of stuff in space, and I would submit that if all the others are interesting, that one must be too. And that if you're faced with a problem where you need a length scale, that the mean, that this L1 is a good place to look. All right. So now let's go back to the von Neumann relation. Let's rewrite this. This is equal to, so the number of points around my region G, well, that's just L, the number of triple points is just L0 of the set of triple points. L1, yeah, L0 of the grain, I'll call it grain triple, the set of triple points around my particular grain G, and then minus 6 times L0 of G. Well, G has one region and no holes, so L0 of G is 1. Well, that may look like just playing around, but actually this is a better formula. This is the true one and this is the false one. If you had a grain with a hole in it, then this formula wouldn't be correct. Von Neumann never considered that. Maybe he didn't expect grains with holes in them. But you can deposit a limited amount of material so that your grain consists of somebody else. I mean, you can put a different material inside there, a different crystal inside there, and then this formula would be false and this formula would be correct. So actually that is the proper way to write it. And now I'll put it here. The answer, this is joint work with David Solovich, a material scientist who just left Princeton to become dean of yeshiva, to my disappointment, is that the 3D analog of the Von Neumann formula is that d area, d volume of a grain, assuming the standard model, dt is equal to some constant depending on the known constant depending on the temperature of materials before of L1 of G triple minus L1 of minus 6 L1 of G. So you add 1 to the dimension of the space and to the L's.
That's really L3 on the left.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, and that's really L2 up there. Which leads you to ask if there's a whole bunch of such formulas, but every other, it's more complicated than that, unfortunately. Well, I don't know if anyone cares, but this model of grain growth makes equally good sense in 4-space, and the obvious answer is what you get. In 4D, D of 4-dimensional volume, DT, or DL4, DT is equal to K times L2 of the grain triple minus 6 times L1 of G. This 6, which occurred originally in von Neumann's paper, stays 6 throughout the discussion. Thank you. Whatever I said, I meant L2. Yes. Okay. Well, what does a grain in free space look like? It's something with bulging sides like a sphere that's been like a cube that's been inflated a little bit, and the triple points are these sort of edge-like things where the two sides of this come together and a third side comes together. And so if this is G, then G triple is the union of all these things. And so so that's G triple. And taking L1 is just simply, of a one-dimensional object, is just taking its length. So this is saying that it's the sum of the lengths of all these triple lines coming around minus 6 times L1 of G. Since both sides are I did say that L1 scales as length, so both sides are scaling as length and it has the right scale. Anyhow, that that gives you the answer. Somehow intuitively, what's going on here, these edges here are pulling, trying to make the thing bigger, whereas it naturally wants to become smaller. So the more of those edges you have, the more likely it is to grow. And here, these membranes are pulling to make it bigger, and so the more length of those edges you have, the more it wants to grow. But I must say, I was completely surprised that it did not involve these points of the formula. I expected the formula to involve those points. I think a lot of people expected it to.
What do you mean by the triple points in three states? So if you just have a cubic lattice,
A cubic lattice would never be the I should have brought my model. So there's a beautiful discovery by Lord Kelvin of a lattice in three space, which actually does this, the sort of Kelvin green structure. See, a cubic lattice would have four things coming in to an edge, and the idea is if you actually made a material like that, then immediately those four things would separate to something like this, crossed with an interval. That four-tuple edge would pull apart because you would have an energy gain by pulling it apart. So that's not addressed by the standard model. Lord Kelvin did come up with something which is addressed, which is a very beautiful thing to look at, but where four spaces partitioned into these polyhedra, and wherever the edges of it, three of the polyhedra come together on an edge. So that's what I mean by L triple. They're truncated octahedra, it works actually in. I mean, it's a beautiful picture associated. I can't resist associating to affine Lie algebra.
And are all the cells contained?
Yes, that's right. It's a permutahedron, otherwise known as the symmetry group for A4. And if you take A4 tilde, you get this thing. And anyhow. They will look like part of the standard model, but I think it follows from the rest. They will look like what happens if you take a wire tetrahedron and dip it in soap, and then you get these six edges coming together, and four regions. I mean, it behaves like Gibbs phase rule. Two grains come together in codimension 1, 3 grains come together in codimension 2, 4 grains come together in codimension 3, and so on, always in higher dimensions. Well, the rest of what I'd like to do, I should say, by the way, that there are these guys is this good for anything? Anyhow, there are a couple of groups in Pittsburgh who are actually calculating this mean width. I don't think anybody cared about it numerically enough to calculate it before, but now they're getting remarkably accurate answers. I would have never expected this. They're getting it directly from the definition. They slice. They have this thing stored in the computer with voxels, with some computer simulation, and they slice it with planes and calculate Euler characteristics, and they get the right answer to two decimal places. It's completely remarkable. And also, there are various other formulas to calculate it. So, in fact, you can use this for getting answers. What I wanted to do with the remaining time is just give a little bit more advertisement for these for this mean width. So just give it two of the most salient properties that would make a pure mathematician, I believe, think that it's a good thing to be studying. So first of all, Li is is rotation and translation invariant. That's pretty clear. And Li scales with the ith power. That is, Li of, suppose I dilate B by a factor of T, that's T to the ith power times Li of B. So I guess I, yes, L0 comes in, L0 is a pure number, it's another characteristic. L1 is like a length. L2 is always like an area, L3 is always like a volume, and so on. Third, Li of A union B is equal to Li of A plus Li of B minus Li of A intersect B, just like Lebesgue measure. It's called additivity. Well, of course, you know that's true for volume. You can draw a few pictures and deduce that it's true for the surface area from these two formulas, but it's also true for L1. It's completely blew my mind to realize to understand that there was a length scale which satisfied that. And then there's Heidegger's theorem. Which says that among convex sets, if we have 1, 2, 3 plus continuity, this implies this characterizes Li up to a scalar multiple. In other words, and I've normalized it so that you get the, on the diagonal here, you get the actual volume. So you get the volume here, the area here, the length here, and the number of points there.
So that's an old theorem?
That dates from exactly the same decade as von Neumann and Mullins. It's from the 50s. Various groups over history have sort of, small groups of mathematicians have discovered this. But then other people rediscover it, and that one reason this doesn't have a standard name. It has many, many different standard names.
Would you
say that the
specific definition of Li
is
just given?
No. Heidegger knew this. Oh, sorry. For a convex set, you don't need Euler characteristics, and so it's just, it's a pretty clear thing for convex set people to think about. So let me pose a pure math problem. Extend this. Find the class of sets for which this is well defined, which includes all convex sets, and a definition of continuity such that this theorem is true. I think it's hard. Particularly recently, there have been all sorts of extensions of this to various classes of sets, subanalytic sets, Whitney stratified sets with certain extra tangentiality conditions, but those don't include all convex sets, and so it's somehow not getting to the heart of the matter, and I think. If you think about it, well, there are people here who know much more about this than me, but there's a sort of a unique good topology on the set of convex sets that everybody would think of. But on more general sets, you get all lost when you try to think of what the natural topology is, particularly one for which these guys are continuous. Okay. Well, let me just end with one more property. I mean, one could go on for quite a while with very nice properties of this measure, but here's one which particularly appeals to the materials science community, and that's Steiner's theorem. Although this statement postdates Steiner a lot, Steiner produced some analog of this. Now, suppose you have some set, then say A, then we can take the epsilon neighborhood of A, if epsilon is some number, and that's all things which are distance at most epsilon from A. So Steiner's theorem says that the volume of N of epsilon of A is equal to L3 of A plus 2L2 of A epsilon plus 2 pi L1 of A epsilon squared plus 4 pi over 3 L0 of A epsilon cubed, provided every point in N sub epsilon of A has a unique closest point in A. Okay, a word on the hypotheses. For many sets, if epsilon is small enough, this is true. But for this set here, if I took a point out here, it doesn't have a unique closest point. It's equally distant from that point and that point. So epsilon has to be smaller than the distance to here, but the one I've drawn is okay. And in general, for grains, they're definitely not convex, so the convex theory is not good enough, but they almost surely satisfy this hypothesis. For small enough A, so that means all you have to do is take this, take its expansion, power series expansion, and that gives you all of these LIs at the same time. These coefficients, by the way, this is the length of a sphere of radius 1 and 2 space, the area of a circle of radius 1 and the length of a line, length of a sphere of radius 1 in 1 space, the area of a circle in 2 space, and the length of a sphere in 3 space. So everything I've been saying here generalizes to higher dimensions. I should say material science is particularly like this because Sorovitz and I showed that this is important in material science, but this is also important in material science. It's one of the models for crystal growth. If you're in a liquid medium and you have a crystal which is growing, under certain hypotheses, it grows like this, and so the volume of it. It's interesting. Oh, what should it be? Is that right? as I said, our freshmen know these. Well, thank you.
Are there questions for Bob?
Oh, yeah. I think that. I mean, there's a film in elementary geometry, which I didn't know, but we discovered somehow that if you have a point on a surface and you want to calculate its mean curvature, one way to do that is to section it with all possible planes and take the curvature of that section at that point and then average it over all possible planes. So that's a true statement, and that was a starting point for me, and so that led to the idea. I mean, so what is the